Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 480th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also an adjunct professor at the U of A.
And today, we're going to talk about concepts and guidelines and a few other things. And
it's just some topics that we might have brushed over.
Yes.
Ever so slightly in the past. We want to go back because we know you haven't heard about them enough. Things like blood pressure and diabetes,
yeah.
Guidelines, and baffling levels of evidence.
Yeah.
Things baffling.
And the reason we're bringing them up is not because we just want to bring them up. It's because there's two major articles that have come out in just probably about the last month, I guess, some just in the last week or so, that have looked at sort of blood pressure guidelines and also diabetes guidelines, although they're not purely diabetes. They're just looking at the SGLT2s and the GLPs. And so what we wanted to do is sort of review them for you, not in detail in what they're, their approach to it all, but just what they're sort of saying and whether or not it means that we should be doing some things differently, I guess.
And James will describe many of the figures, so brace yourself.
This will I shall not be doing that.
4-hour
podcast. So let's start with blood pressure, because that was the one that came out the earliest of these two, and it was published in The Lancet just in 2021, and it was called The Pharmacological Blood Pressure Lowering for Primary and Secondary Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease Across Different Levels of Blood Pressure. And this is put together by a group called the Blood Pressure Lowering Treatment Trialist Collaboration. And these guys are originally some of the authors of the original studies that were done in blood pressure. And from what I could gather, they are a group that now no longer gets funding from industry in the last 15 years. So they're trying to, they're trying to get all of the data and put it all together. And what they were able to do was do an individual participant level data meta-analysis. And that can mean a number of different things. In this case, what it meant is that they were able to get every person who was in the trial and find out what their baseline blood pressure was and then figure out what happened to them. Now, one would argue that you'd also want to know how much was their blood pressure lowered. They don't address that issue at all. We've actually sent in a letter, Scott Garrison, who's with our group, we sent in a letter, I don't know if they'll publish it, asking why did you not at least look at that to see if there was some other information you could tease out of it. But what it allows us to do is look at, and what they did was to say, what happens when you lower blood pressure by a certain amount in a variety of different thresholds of blood pressure? And is there anything else I need to say about that, Mike?
No, that's setting it up nicely. It's a big project.
Yeah. So there's 48 randomized trials that they used, and they looked at different blood pressure lowering medications versus placebo or other classes of blood pressure lowering. They looked at more versus less intensive treatment regimens. And when I went through this article, I found it really interesting just to hear their sort of approach to the way they were thinking about it. And I'm just going to give you some quotes that they came out, and they said, "This study provides evidence against the widely held view that an individual's blood pressure or previous diagnosis of cardiovascular disease are key factors for selecting or deselecting participants for blood pressure lowering treatment." Because that's quite a statement to make. I would think you would agree, Mike.
Yep, it is. It's sweeping.
Yes. And I would suggest that really what they're showing doesn't allow you to make that. Even though I agree with that comment, I don't know if the data really applies, because they show that for most different thresholds, if you lower blood pressure, you see a benefit primarily in cardiovascular events, but also in some cases, depending on their baseline risk, in mortality.
Right. That is true. So they've got a bunch of different, because they use their baseline blood pressure as almost like a risk factor, you would think that more, you would get more benefit as you go up with higher blood pressures. But what they did was they also set the standard at reduction in blood pressure at 5 millimeters of mercury. Mm-hmm. So they standardized everything to that, which I would say would slightly bias things. And you and I have talked about mm-hmm. this, James.
Yeah.
If you give a blood pressure pill to someone who is, and this is averages, if you give blood pressure pills to someone who's 180, a whole population of patients who are around 180, mm-hmm. the reduction from ramipril 10 milligrams with them is different than the what you can expect from a blood pressure reduction for patients at 140.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not hugely different, but it is different.
Yeah.
And so the reduction will be more when they have higher blood pressures. And if you think about it, as James pointed out before, it's probably very similar in the percent reduction, but because you're starting out with a bigger number, it's yeah. easier to have an absolute difference that's bigger.
Yeah. So we might talk a little bit about the numbers. So you might see about, you know, as Mike's saying, if you start at 170 and give a single drug, you might see a 10 millimeter reduction in systolic. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're talking 140, 130, now we're talking maybe five.
Yeah, or, five or somewhere. Six.
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I've always said on average, you see about a seven, you know, and yeah. that's just, yeah. you know, that's what you sort of see. So it's not a perfect way to sort of present the information in my mind, but it does show you that it give you a ballpark idea of roughly what would happen if you give a blood pressure medication, given that you might see more if you had a higher blood pressure. And so they looked at a whole bunch of different categories. So they looked at all the different categories you can imagine, even less than 120. So they went less than 120, 120 to 129, 130 to 139, and they broke it all the way down to all the way up to anything greater than 170. And they showed a fairly consistent reduction in from a relative perspective of around, I guess you could say 10%, Mike, roughly. It looks like depending on what, on whether you look at previous cardiovascular disease or no previous cardiovascular disease. Right. With no cardiovascular disease, you know, you're maybe pushing it a little bit closer. No, maybe not. But right around 10, maybe 15%.
So, yeah, the challenge here, that the reason you hear James struggling, is when you're looking at a lot of these things, when you take a group of data and you get something really rounded, up at the start of this paper, they say that the reduction in major cardiovascular events is around 0.9. Mm-hmm. So it's
a 10% relative.
0.89 if it's in people who've had cardiovascular disease, and those who haven't, it's 0.91. Then when you start to tease out individual outcomes over this huge range of blood pressure differences, you've got so many subgroups that naturally the events are going to wiggle back and forth quite a bit.
Right.
And so you could, if you're one of the people who loves to do this, you could easily pick one outcome for one blood pressure range and say, oh, it's not working. Or you could do it the other way and say, wow, this works like dynamite.
Exactly.
But that's just variability, and it means almost nothing. I go back to the key finding, which is at the beginning, if you do 5 millimeters of mercury reduction, you're going to get somewhere around a 10% relative reduction in
exactly.
events.
Yeah.
Recognizing that the more blood pressure you have, you do more than 5 millimeters of mercury, so you're going to get maybe double that.
Yeah.
We don't really know because this study doesn't address that.
Yeah, no, exactly. So we're looking at around a 10%. And so we've talked to you guys for 479 other episodes about, so what do you do with this 10% reduction? Well, you put it to the baseline, their baseline risk, because it's not what their blood pressure is, it's what their baseline cardiovascular risk is if you're going to see a 10% benefit. And so the reason that I'm bringing this up is that along with this meta-analysis, there was also an editorial that looked at this meta-analysis, and they came up with some, I think, again, not completely innovative ideas, because we've been sort of talking about this for years, but not a lot of guideline people are saying that, you know, you don't have to necessarily look at you don't need blood pressure thresholds. And they suggest that it really calls for simple, reliable, multivariable risk prediction tools made readily available. And for those of you guys who have been following the podcast, you know that we've created a number of these. And you know, we obviously believe that that's the approach that you can take, if for no other reason is that it informs people better than saying, oh my goodness, boy, is your blood pressure high.
Well, that will get them on drugs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or and then call it the silent killer and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Fear.
Yeah.
Fear is a big motivator.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. It is true that that will work, but that is not, as we've talked for 479 podcasts, that's not a great way to have a conversation.
No.
About risks and benefits.
No. So. But it's really good. I think it's really good to see. This is a major editorial in a major journal coming out and saying, we don't need to worry so much about blood pressure thresholds. What we should be doing is getting the 5 or 6 characteristics that we need to make a ballpark decent assessment of their cardiovascular risk. And then say, if we were to give you a blood pressure medication, and they don't specifically talk about any individual blood pressure medication.
No.
If you give them one, this is roughly the benefit that you might get. And a 10%, you know, Mike, you've argued, well, maybe it's a bit more, you know, maybe it's 15% if you get more of a blood pressure lowering effect. But 10% is just a simple number to go. You go, your baseline risk is 10%, we might be able to get you down to 9%. Your baseline risk is 20, we might be able to get you down to about 18. If we gave you 2 or 3 medications, if you started at 170, maybe we could get a greater benefit. But it's not to get them to a target blood pressure, because you know as well as I do, if you go get away from that, you solve a whole bunch of pain in the ass problems. Right? You don't have to do the Excel spreadsheets of blood pressures that people bring in. You don't.
I was thinking about what you said, James, and that you could, you know, the ideal risk calculator for cardiovascular disease to include blood pressure would include all the risk factors that we know so well. Plus, what it would do is if your blood pressure was at 180, let's say, it would take into account what your likely lowering is with intervention A, B, C, right? And then you could say, based on that 5 millimeters of mercury idea, that, you know, well, if you're going to take a more potent one like chlorothalidone, we can expect this. And the downside is you can have disruption of your electrolytes, so now you need monitoring of your electrolytes when you start, and no one knows the right answer here, so it's often advocated once a year, maybe twice, once every 2 years, who knows. But you can have those conversations, but boy, that risk calculator, that risk estimator and benefit estimator would be so complex. Be such a challenge for us.
Exactly.
Fortunately, that's in your side of the house. I just make the brilliant recommendations like, I think a prettier blue color would be better here.
Yes, yeah, that's and always well received.
And that's pretty much at the top of my, you're taxing my intellectual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't, yeah, it basically comes back. I like blue. but I think that, but the point is that what they're advocating, even though their data doesn't, you can't really do a study to say this is the best way to do this. But I think, you know, if you don't have evidence of one way being better, you should do it the more simple way. And so I know you've heard it here first. So why not say, you know, this is your blood pressure. We're not going to, it's not whether it's 140 or 141 or 139. We're going to put it into the assessment of a cardiovascular risk. And then what we'll do is we'll say, if, you know, we can use any blood pressure medication you want, because the nice thing about it, Mike, and you know, I'm going to talk about low dose, but you get, there's oodles of studies showing that if you use literally the lowest available dose of any blood pressure medication, that's where you get almost all of the blood pressure lowering effect anyway, and probably lower side effects. So, you know, starting with, you know, 2.5 or 1.25 of an ACE inhibitor, or 6.25 of a thiazide, or you know, any of those.
I think at 2.5 of a ramipril, you get 60% of the blood pressure lowering that you get at 10 milligrams. So
exactly.
4 times the dose with about 40%.
I think you're close. I think you might even get a little bit more from the lower dose, but yeah, that's what we're talking about. And the reason that we want lower doses, there's all sorts of advantages. You should get less side effects. You don't get dramatic reductions in blood pressure that you worry about people, you know, falling over and, you know, all those sorts of things. and there's less cost because you can split pills. And again, if you don't use a, if you don't have people worry about their threshold, their blood pressure threshold, you just get them to worry about, did they have side effects? And that's things, most importantly, things like lightheadedness or just not feeling very good on these medications, and say, that's what we're going to judge whether we've had a success with this. We know the benefit that you're going to get, roughly 10%. We have no idea if you will ever get that benefit because it's kind of a lottery system. But that would take away the worry about getting to certain numbers. And we could also tell people, unless you get symptoms of maybe low blood pressure, you don't really need to measure it. You know, that... Once we put you on a medication, now if you're at 180, 190, that's a dip. We're not talking about those people, but the vast majority of people with high blood pressure are not the 170s or 180s or 190s.
Yeah, I think the cost and expense of measuring blood pressure is small, so I don't think we need to advocate for discarding it entirely.
No, not yet. Well, I would say you know, the blood pressure cuffs, you know, a decent one. I'm trying to think what they would be.
Oh, I'm not talking about that. Like they're in the office and you're just going to check their.
There's a cost associated with them coming into the office. Yep. To get it measured. Yep. And then, you know, the yearly or the every 6 months, or we gave you a blood pressure medication. Let's see what it did to your blood pressure.
None of that. I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah. Okay.
But what I'm saying is over time, things can change, right?
Yeah.
And so it might be worthwhile to reassess where risk is.
Yes.
Not for the blood pressure per se, but if you check their blood pressure again in 4 years and their blood pressure was 120, you might have an activity to do there, which is evaluate whether it's really needed and say, you know, maybe we need to check it a few more times and maybe you don't need.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because that almost goes against because that meta-analysis did show that at any blood pressure, whether it be 121, whatever, you seem to see a benefit.
Yeah. And that would be true if there were absolutely no adverse events.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. And really, I mean, you know, and unless you have blood pressures in the 200 systolics and stuff, side effects are unacceptable for blood pressure medications. I mean, they really are. I mean,
you are committing sacrilege here.
Well, you know, I guess unless you go, you know, are you okay being lightheaded for a 1% benefit or a 2% benefit over, you know, 5 to 10 years? If you're okay with that, then great.
Yeah, that certainly is the case. But if you have somebody who's very high blood pressure with lots of risk, that would change.
Yeah, I agree. But if their risk, you know, is 20 to 25%, and you might be able to get rid of 3% of that, then now you might accept. I don't think you can ever accept an ongoing side effect. You might accept it till you start to tolerate it a little bit better, but I don't know an ongoing one. I mean, I don't think anyone would take a ACE inhibitor if it made them cough on a regular basis, because that's just annoying.
Nope, it is annoying.
Yeah.
So to talk about the next study.
So the other one was sort of in a similar vein, and this came out of the BMJ just a few days ago. And what this was a... what they called a rapid recommendation. And you know, the BMJ is doing actually a pretty decent job of trying to improve guidelines. I think they do a good job in some areas. We're going to talk about some other areas where they don't do quite such a good job. But these are rapid recommendations, and they're being overseen by a group of people who know how to do meta-analyses and systematic reviews. And they just put out one, and it was entitled... the exact title, SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP receptor antagonists for adults with type 2 diabetes, a clinical practice guideline. And what they did is they published the guideline. And then as they do, they put out infographics, which are basically visual summaries of the recommendations and the article and all that sort of stuff. So basically, they're literally focusing on just these two newer agents. And we were talking earlier, Mike, about the reasons for them. One, they actually... some of these do have evidence of some benefit, but they're also expensive and they're new, and people are trying to figure out what to do with them.
Yeah, it is very tricky. And so, you know, if you look at the evidence for diabetic medications. Mm-hmm. You've got metformin, which is a pretty positive maybe.
Yeah. That's a very strong positive. Yeah. I mean, it's tricky. I mean, let's at least give the UK PDS says it has an effect, but when you do a meta-analysis of it, there's not a lot of information. But in this guideline, they're saying, when do we add these to people who are already on metformin?
Yeah, and so when you think about what's next after metformin, mm-hmm. there's lots of medication choices, but surprisingly, none of them have shown to reduce cardiovascular disease or outcomes that matter. Mm-hmm. And that is the sulfonylureas. Insulin's included in there, and it has been well studied and not found benefit mm-hmm. In events that are like cardiovascular events, yeah. which make up the majority of events for diabetics. DPP-4s, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. What you're left with is two very expensive drugs that do have an effect.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the magnitude in a minute. But yeah, exactly. And again, let's caveat this. We are pretty much exclusively talking about people who come in for screening and find out they have diabetes, not for the people that have big glucose numbers. They feel yucky. You know, they're thirsty all the time. That's not who we're talking about. We're primarily talking about the diabetic people that we identify. Because, you know, it's hard to make an asymptomatic person feel better. So in this case, I think, you know, we're talking primarily that person who comes into your office, their A1C is 8 and 8.5 or somewhere between maybe 7 and 8.5. And you're going, oh, you have diabetes type of thing. I think you'd agree with that, right?
That's who we're talking about here primarily. Yeah, we're not talking about someone who is symptomatic and all of those kind of things. That's a different ball of wax.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah, yeah. And so the way that they present their information, again, it's kind of what they did in the blood pressure. They're saying, we're not necessarily considering that these drugs lower glucose, because actually when you look at it, there is way less data on lowering glucose and having a benefit than there is with lowering blood pressure, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Depends on how you look at it with the aggressive control of blood glucose, but there are three main studies and two possible ones, the UK PDS, the ones you mentioned. There's many of them, but the two that most get referred to. Mm-hmm. Then Accord, Advance, and Veterans. And so those ones, and they're often, there's a lot of special pleading around those trials because people don't like what they said, which mm-hmm. is it didn't really work well to aggressively lower blood glucose.
Yeah. So they're pretty much taking these medications like they did with the blood pressure. These are risk reduction medications. They're not so much medications for diabetes, if you will. And so what they do is they talk about that what we should be doing again is basing it on the concept of risk and how many other risk factors you have and so on. Now in my opinion, they do an outstanding job of collecting the data, putting it together, coming up with some of the numbers that are pretty usable. Where they fall apart a little bit is they, for some reason, have decided they have to give what they call either strong or weak recommendations. And those strong and weak recommendations are based on asking panel members, not necessarily people with diabetes, whether or not they think most or all people would be willing to take these medications based on what the information is. And I don't really care what they say. You know what I mean? I don't care what they think people might take. And it was really interesting because in the body of that guideline, they did have a relatively small patient group that they asked. There were 7 patients that they asked for another purpose, not to decide whether it would be a weak or a strong recommendation. And they asked them and they said, and they found of the 7, 2 were willing to accept very small benefits, like basically anything, while 2 would decline it even if they had the largest benefit. But that's life.
Yeah. Right?
So it doesn't matter what, you still have to do the individual discussion with these people to figure out you know, do you, is this benefit of value to you to, given the potential complications? And then they recommend a calculator that, again, is really a useful calculator, but it's not user friendly at all. It's very complicated. It's complicated to use. You can't use it the way our CBD calculator is used. And in fact, I'm going to, I think at some point try to, I've reached out in previously to try and see if we can make it a little bit of a, you know, make it a little bit more user friendly. But then they come up with all of these categories of, you know, weak and strong recommendations. And then I know you struggle trying to even figure out what the infographic was recommending.
Yeah, no, it's a very confusing infographic, which is unfortunate because BMJ was one of the leaders of the crusade to try and
absolutely
fix guidelines and help primary care and promote decision aids. But the model that they've created, in my mind, is and people should understand, we have a bias, James and I, because we do this now.
Yeah.
So we might be seeing it from that tainted viewpoint. But when I look at this, I find it, the colors quite overwhelming, and the whole, and here I am with colors again. Mm-hmm. I like blue. Mm-hmm. But also just the way they've tried to break down whether it's a strong and weak recommendation.
Yeah.
I don't know that that helps that much for patients and even care providers. I think I think it could have been much clearer. The evidence overall is not, it's clear, I would say, that it has a small effect.
Yeah,
and I think it would just be, you know, for all of these things, it's not, I don't think you should be having strong and weak recommendations. It should be a recommendation to talk to patients.
Yeah, no, exactly. About
the risks and benefits of each of these. And if you did that, if that's the route you went, boy, would this ever simplify.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in a little bit of defense of the BMJ, I have seen other infographics that they've done that have been very good. This one, it just, I couldn't, it took me a long time to figure it out, and it shouldn't. It should be completely obvious. But so here's what they came out recommending. They broke it down into a variety of different categories. They said people who have three or fewer risk factors, and the risk factors that we're primarily talking about are usually an age thing over age 60. If you're male, if you have an elevated A1C above 6.5, if you're a smoker, if you got blood pressure over 140 and your cholesterol is higher than 5.2, blah, blah, all those things. So if you have less, three or fewer risk factors, they say don't use them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based on the premise, even though when you look at it, there appears to be a benefit for reducing overall bad outcomes, mortality, and so on. But we're talking at most 1% over 5 years as the benefit. We're talking, and they don't actually present it in absolute numbers. In percentages, they say how many people would benefit per 1,000 over 5 years, and they're talking somewhere around 10. So that's about a 1% difference. And then when you look at the side effects, about, you know, with the SGLT2s, they say about 14% of people will get an adverse event with those, and primarily genital infections. And then the GLPs, about 3% will get severe GI things. So sort of the benefit, the harm is probably greater than the benefit, especially when these drugs cost thousands of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep, they are expensive. So, they are crazy expensive. The GLP-1s in Canada averaging about twice what SGLT2s are.
I think they're getting upwards like of the 10th, you know, upwards of, if you take them over 5 years, you know, you're talking about, I think, $10,000 over 5 years, something. I think that's about the amount. It gets pretty expensive. I think they're in the neighborhood. I think, don't quote me. I think somewhere like $1,000 a year and then $2,000 a year, depending on, I guess, the doses and all that sort of stuff. They're not inexpensive. Let's put it that way.
No, they're not. Yeah. And the benefits, well, they have benefits that the other drugs don't have. I think many patients will, if they have to pay out of pocket, will struggle to reconcile that cost.
Yeah. And then they break it down. And the people who have more than three risk factors, they're saying use an SGLT2, but don't use a GLP-1. And again, looking, I don't quite understand why they went that way. It looks like the SGLT2s have a little bit greater benefit, probably about a 3% benefit over 5 years. versus sort of a 2 to 2.5 for the GLP ones. Maybe that's why they did it. I don't know. It's hard for me to figure out that. And then now, so those are people without pre-existing conditions. Now, when you get to people who have either pre-existing cardiovascular disease or pre-existing renal disease, and I tried to find the definition of renal disease in what they were talking about, and I couldn't find that. They didn't describe it from what I could find. And in most of the cases, they're saying you could use either one of these agents, right? I think that was their recommendation, even though all of their recommendations were, except when you got a person who's got both cardiovascular disease and renal disease, most of them were weak recommendations in that not everybody would want to take them.
So their definition of chronic kidney disease, James, is at the top right corner of the infographic. Yeah.
What did they
say?
Less
than 60 for GFR.
Oh, and, okay. Good. I must have missed that.
30 albumin creatinine ratio.
Okay, so. Cool. Okay, excellent. That's why we have two people look at these things. Because I didn't look in that top corner, I guess, because I was frustrated with the gut. Yeah. You know what? I think, you know why I didn't find it? I just looked at the paper. I couldn't find it in the paper, but maybe I missed it there too. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you're talking about patients with pre-existing cardiovascular disease, you're looking at maybe about, 5% benefit over 5 years is what the numbers they're quoting, roughly speaking. And then when you've got renal disease, you're maybe talking somewhere around 7 to 10% absolute benefit. So in that population, you're starting to get a benefit that might be something that people would consider.
Well, no. Remember, there are people that they had look at it.
Oh, no, I know.
Would have taken anything.
Absolutely.
And two, there's nothing that they would take out of seven.
So I'm thinking, I'm saying that you'd probably find more people.
Yeah. Okay. But the three in the middle, you're swaying them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because we're not sure. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this is a very useful, there's very useful information in there, but you really have to hunt and peck and try and find out what it all means. Now that I've looked at it a lot, I get what the messaging that they were trying to get across, but I think they could have done it in a more simple, user-friendly fashion and create calculators that are useful because.
Yeah. And the infographic, all you would need to do is instead of having all these risk factors, just have it as a calculator and, it could make a recommendation for like even just shading, like discuss or encourage, right?
Exactly.
Those two words and they would mean slightly different things and then their very definition, discuss means you're not going to be pushy. Encourage means you're going to be a bit pushy.
But they want to use strong, which means all or nearly all people would use it. Whereas weak means most.
Yeah. I don't know what that. Yeah. And then you could easily have in there what the benefits are for patients, but your risk is, I'm just throwing a number out there, 20. And if we give you this drug, it'll be 17 or 16.
Yeah.
I'd like to take it.
Exactly. Yeah. And even in the guideline, they say, we did not look at cost, but I think their argument was because it's different from different countries, which is true.
Yeah. But it's not,
it's still going to
be more expensive than, sulfonylureas or what you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And so I think, I think there needs to be a recognition of that, at least to say, like when I've spoken on diabetes before and talk about these drugs, I say at least something like, darn it, they cost a lot.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so what we've tried to do is these will influence people, Mike, these two publications.
You have more hope than I do, James. I think what they do is, they lend support to the concept of looking at risk more than looking at surrogate markers. And I certainly don't disagree with that concept, but they in themselves, there have been lots of papers that have tilted at that particular windmill for a long time. They've been being published for a long time. I do remember seeing hypertension papers that have said we should be focused on risk, not blood pressure levels, but it will be slow to change.
Yeah, when I said they'd be influential, I mean they are in influential journals, so people will be looking at them and reading them, and then fundamentally ignoring them.
Yeah, because It all boils back to that cognitive stuff that we talked about before. If this doesn't agree with my belief system, I mean, this really rang true with you because of course, your belief system. But if we were, you know, of different hypertension societies or endocrinology societies, we would probably have not have keyed in on these papers at all.
Yeah, no, probably not. And also, you know, if you're still being paid to get people's blood pressures and glucoses down to certain numbers, you basically ignore this.
Yeah.
Because you have, you can't, you know, so anyway, we thought that these would be of interest, not so much, you know, the absolute nuances of everything, but just sort of the discussion around, you know, how to think about guidelines and recommendations and risk reduction and all that stuff. I know we've done it many times before, but this stuff is still coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to talk about, Mike?
Nope, that's good, James.
Yeah, so I think we'll just leave it at that then. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.